The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. On today's show, we'll talk a little bit later about the many presidential candidates there in the U.S. who are promising to lead America down a new and different road. They're promising a change in course. Lots of promises, as we're used to hearing every campaign season. But can America actually change the course that it's on? We'll look at that in just a moment, focusing in on an article that appeared in the Washington Times. And then also on today's show, there's the much-publicized documentary coming up tonight on Channel 4 here in the UK, What British Muslims Really Think. It's getting quite a bit of publicity, as I said. I haven't seen it yet, but there are quite a few articles that are appearing about this this comprehensive study or survey that gets into what, in some cases, a majority of British Muslims, what they really think about British society, about Sharia law, about polygamy, and other topics, as we'll get into later. Well, first, I'd like to just start with what we alluded to yesterday. We went through a bit of that coworker letter that my father just sent out to our supporters, and he drew attention to all these events over the years that have happened on January the 16th. Of course, the most recent one being just this past January, January 16th, 2016, and the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That's what my father called the Iran nuclear deal. You can go back and look at the April issue of the Trumpet magazine. And he talked about how even though President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry were saying that the world became a safer place on January the 16th, in fact, it became much more dangerous. And he said Iran is going to become more aggressive, more subversive. It's going to be emboldened to sponsor more terrorism. We gave up everything in return for nothing, he said. And then there's this quote, this deal does not make the world safer. It's a disaster for the world. And the fact that many people say it's a cause for celebration is a sure sign of tragically broken leadership. Yes, it is a sign of just how tragic, of how weak American leadership really is. You can't negotiate with nations that are obsessed with your own destruction. Here we are negotiating with the worst terrorist sponsoring nation on earth. And we're just inviting them right into our house, so to speak. Inviting them right into the community of nations. And it's not leading to peace. It's leading to great tribulation, as Jesus discussed in Matthew 24. It's leading to nuclear explosions. It's leading to mass destruction. Look at what Iran has been doing just since that deal was implemented. Firing all these intercontinental ballistic missiles. I mean, the agreement itself, if you just look at the UN Security Council resolution 2231, the resolution passed in July of last year, And my father brought this out in his article in the April issue, that it prevented Iran, or it called upon Iran not to fire ballistic missiles until after 8 years. They had to at least wait 8 years. They didn't even wait 8 minutes. They've been firing them this year and last year. They haven't slowed down anything. In fact, they've accelerated it. Let me just read to you this paragraph, this clause from the UN Security Council Resolution 2231, and I'm reading this to set up another story that was in the Washington Free Beacon. But this is Resolution 2231. It says, Iran is called upon not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons, including launches using such ballistic missile technology, until the date 8 years after the JCPOA adoption day, or until the date on which the IAEA submits a report confirming the broader conclusion, whichever is earlier. So for 8 years, they had to wait. And this resolution, and there were those at the time, senators in the U.S., that said, well, why should it be worded with called upon? Why not just, Iran shall not undertake any activity? But the language was a little weak to begin with. And then when you add to that what they're doing and saying now, what Iran's doing, and what U.S. leaders are saying, and you come back to this tragically broken leadership, childish leadership, weak leadership, leaders in the United States that are actually covering for Iran, covering for the mullahs, covering for their ballistic missile program. And so there is the wording. I just read it to you, the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. And Iran keeps firing ballistic missiles and says, well, the wording in that resolution doesn't prohibit our launchings because those missiles aren't intended for nuclear weapons, so there's no violation here. And critics are saying there's a violation, and Iran is getting upset and angry. Let me just take you back to what happened in October. This is just a couple of days after they fired a missile, and this is how, at the time, this is how White House spokesman Josh Earnest responded.
We've got strong indications that those missile tests did violate UN Security Council resolutions that pertain to Iran's ballistic missile activities. Unfortunately, that's not new. We have seen Iran on almost serially violate the international community's concerns about their ballistic missile program. And the UN Security Council resolution actually gives the international community some tools to interdict some equipment and material that could be used to advance their ballistic missile program, and gives us the ability to work in concert with our partners around the world to engage a strategy to try to disrupt continued progress of their ballistic missile program. But this is altogether separate from the nuclear agreement that Iran reached with the rest of the world. In contrast to the repeated violations of the UN Security Council resolution that pertains to their ballistic missile activities, we've seen that Iran, over the last couple of years, has demonstrated a track record of abiding by the commitments that they made in the context of the nuclear talks.
Lots of interesting comments there. For one, he said it did. This is how they covered for it months ago, last year. Okay, it does violate a UN Security Council resolution that pertains to the ballistic missile activities, but this is separate and apart from the nuclear agreement. It's separate and apart from the deal that we reached to halt their nuclear program. And he said there at the last that even though they violated all of these agreements, all of the resolutions regarding ballistic missile technology and firings and launchings, that in contrast to that, they've actually abided by all the rules regarding the nuclear program. So they're deceitful, they're cheating, they're violating on these other agreements, but on this one, they're not. They're keeping the law. They're observing the resolution. They're following the rules. That's what the White House is saying. I mentioned the spirit of the law comment that President Obama made a couple of weeks ago. I'll come to that clip again in just a moment. But first, let me take you to a hearing. This is from last week, April 5th, and this is on the Iran nuclear agreement implementation. And you're about to hear Senator Bob Menendez, and the hearing is between him and, well, a bunch of senators who are questioning the Obama administration about the nuclear agreement implementation and about the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 and whether or not Iran is violating the terms of that resolution. But first, let me just play for you a segment of Senator Bob Menendez's opening statement. And again, he's a Democrat. He's a Democrat from New Jersey.
I don't understand when the president himself, in remarks this week, said that while Iran may have followed the letter of the agreement, they have not followed the spirit, sending signals to the world community that is of a series of provocative actions. And among that, failure to follow the spirit, the president himself acknowledged launching ballistic missiles, repeatedly calling for the destruction of Israel, shipping weapons to Hezbollah. Not my comments, the president's comments. Now, to that I would add its status as a state sponsor of terrorism, its acts of aggression designed to destabilize our allies in the region, its efforts to disrupt shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, its illegal detention and despicable humiliation of American sailors, its trafficking in weapons, its cyber attacks events, and I think many of those you recited in your opening statement. So what bothers me is that we seem to create a permissive environment as exemplified by what happened in the missile issues that have been raised and I want to further pursue with you, in which we are treading on eggshells about doing anything else in this whole universe that we admittedly recognize is against the national security interests of the United States.
But all of that, keep in mind, the violations on the missiles, the threats to Israel, supplying Hezbollah, sponsoring terrorism, detaining U.S. sailors, trafficking weapons, cyber attacks, all of that. I mean, in contrast to all of that, they've actually had a pretty good track record on the nuclear agreement. In contrast to all of these other areas where they're repeatedly breaking the rules, with respect to the nuclear agreement, hey, you can trust them. You can trust them. In fact, on this nuclear agreement, as President Obama himself said, I mean, we've seen a lot of progress.
And thanks to this deal, we have seen real progress.
Real progress. Thanks to this deal. You don't see it anywhere else. Not with the missiles. Not with the threats to Israel and the United States, not with the supplying Hezbollah with weapons, not in being the number one state sponsor of terrorism, not in the humiliation of U.S. sailors, not in the trafficking of weapons, not in the repeated cyber attacks against the United States of America. I mean, the most that the president himself can come out and say is that, well, they're violating the spirit of the law. But if you notice from the statement, according to the strict letter, I mean, they've obeyed the rules. Here's what the president said a couple of weeks ago.
Iran so far has followed the letter of the agreement. But the spirit of the agreement involves Iran also sending signals to the world community and businesses that it is not going to be engaging in a range of provocative actions that might scare business off.
So this violation of the spirit, that could scare businesses because, well, they're making threats to Israel. Well, whatever it is in his mind that is the violation of the spirit, but by the strict letter, they're obedient. They're obedient. Now, there's enough still strong voices in Congress who have been quite critical of these repeated ballistic missile launchings, crying out that this is a clear violation of Resolution 2231, a clear violation, which calls on Iran not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons. And so finally, the administration responded to these repeated launchings and submitted a complaint to the United Nations, but one that doesn't say they violated that Resolution 2231, but one that says, well, it's inconsistent with what Resolution 2231 has to say. Now, this is that Washington Free Beacon piece from just today or yesterday, I forget, I don't have the date. It says, Obama administration lawyers are advising officials against describing recent Iranian ballistic missile tests as a violation of the United Nations resolution governing the recently implemented nuclear agreement with Iran, according to multiple U.S. officials and sources familiar with the situation. So we talked last week about the young and the inexperienced advisors inside the White House that are having quite a lot to say about international affairs, about wars internationally. And you could add to that the administration lawyers, President Obama's lawyers, who are advising U.S. officials against describing recent Iranian ballistic missile tests as a violation. Don't use the word violation. And so they aren't. They're using the word inconsistent. It says here the decision has created friction with Congress and inside the administration itself, with officials and lawmakers citing previous statements from the administration declaring that such missile launches would be considered a violation. Secretary of State John Kerry said so himself last year and in the strongest of terms. Well, of course. Of course that would be a violation. And remember all the talk. If they violate it, well, there's sanctions that we can snap right back in place. And we're right back where we were before the agreement. Here we are now, just, well, not even 3 months after implementation. The violations continue. And what does the United States do? It tells its officials to not use the word violation, if you can believe that. Don't use the word violation. It says the stance was walked back after UN Security Council members, such as Russia, said it does not consider the latest Iranian tests a violation of the resolution. A recent letter signed by U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, called the tests inconsistent with the resolution. So you see, Iran and Russia, they don't agree that firing ballistic missiles violates the resolution. And so the U.S. is now changing its wording. It says Congress, this is the Free Beacon story, Congress is now pursuing an inquiry into what lawmakers describe as the Obama administration's efforts to mislead lawmakers about the terms of the nuclear deal. So, well, let's you go back to this April 5th hearing. As I said, that clip previously was the Democrat, Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey. And so here he is again in an exchange with an official representing the White House, the Obama administration. This is Bob Menendez's question, followed by the response from Thomas Shannon, who is the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs.
Why not call it what it is, which is a violation? Which is it? Is it a violation? Or did we soften the language in such a way that permits exactly what Iran is doing now?
The language used in the letter was that Iran's launch was inconsistent with UN Security Council 2231. And not it was in violation of 2231. Again, I would argue that this is a distinction without a difference, because we are convinced that 2231 prohibits these kinds of launches, that there is a strong international commitment to
If that was the case, why did we not use the word violation? If we believe it's prohibited, why did we not use the word violation?
I'm not an international lawyer, sir.
And that's who's governing the policy right now, the international lawyers. And the international lawyers representing the Obama administration are telling Mr. Shannon and other officials representing the United States government to use the word inconsistent and not violation, because Russia doesn't agree that it's a violation. And Iran says they're not violating it. And oh, by the way, Iran is getting pretty upset. And they're telling the United States, you better back off with this, or we walk away from the agreement. And so there's the United States, quite willing to, as Senator Menendez suggested there, to revise the language in order to permit Iran to break the rules. That's what's happening. The Free Beacon says the administration's refusal to label these tests as a violation has sparked anger in Congress, where several lawmakers have accused the administration of walking back its promises about the deal's parameters. All the promises, look, the parameters are in place. Any violation, it's snap back. It's snap back, snap back. Remember, snap back. It's ridiculous that the Obama administration refuses to call Iran's latest launches what they are: direct violations of international ballistic missile restrictions. That's a quote from Senator David Perdue, who's also on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said, "We cannot afford to give this rogue regime the benefit of the doubt any longer. If Iran refuses to be an honest actor and halt its bad behavior, then our policies must change to reflect that reality." I mean, that's what everyone in America was told last year, right? If they refuse to be an honest actor, if they refuse to halt their bad behavior, then our policy has to reflect that reality, does it not? We better snap back. Representative Mike Pompeo told the Free Beacon that there appears to be a strain within the Obama administration over the refusal to outwardly describe Iran's missile tests as a violation. So some, evidently even in the White House, can't believe this is happening. This week, this is quoting Pompeo, this week Foreign Minister Zarif, this is the Iranian foreign minister, asserted that Iran's missile program was not open to negotiation. There are not going to be any changes there coming from Iran. And so what changes are made? Snap the sanctions back in place? No. The changes that the United States is going to make as a result of all these violations is to not call them violations anymore. It says here, while the Iranians are obstinate, this is quoting Pompeo, the Obama administration debates semantics for weeks, ignoring the frightening reality that Iran tested ballistic missiles. That is the frightening reality. And yet you have an administration leading the United States of America that's quite content with revising its policy, with arguing over semantics, with covering. They're quite happy to cover for the regime, for the mullahs. I mean, you would hear so much stronger language coming from this administration if it had to do with Ted Cruz or Donald Trump. But the strongest language that they can come out with, after all of these repeated violations, one after another, after the frightening reality that Iran is testing these ballistic missiles, the strongest language is that, well, it's inconsistent. Now, go back to what my father said in that April edition of The Trumpet. The worst foreign policy blunder in American history. Was he exaggerating? Does that sound like an exaggeration? It's the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That's what we said just recently after that deal was in place. January 16th, 2016. Now, you know all about what we've said about Daniel 11 and verse 40, about what we've said regarding the so-called war against terrorism, and how that by not targeting Iran, by not degrading its support of terrorism, that the problem was only going to get worse, that Iran would only grow stronger, that Iran would only get more pushy, and pushy and pushy, as it says in that passage, Daniel 11:40. That's what they've been doing, pushing and pushing and pushing. And the only thing the United States can do right now is to back down after every push. Of course, we know that push in the prophecy is aimed at Europe, but you can see why the United States is not mentioned in the prophecy. You can see why the United States doesn't even factor into the equation, can't you? We've identified Iran as the king of the South for over 20 years. And just a few months ago, January 16th, 2016, here's the United States welcoming them back right into the community of nations, the number one state sponsor of terrorism. Effectively, as I said on this program, coronating Iran as the king of the South. Handing over the Middle East to the King of the South. Look at what America is doing to help, to aid, to support that King, the King of the South, to support and assist the terrorist cause. Look at how much more powerful the United States has made the King of the South. And your Bible says that Iran will aggressively push at Europe to a point where finally the German-led king of the North, it's going to retaliate, and forcefully so. It will respond finally to that provocation, to that push. And it'll come against the King of the South. It'll come against radical Islam like a whirlwind, as it says there in Daniel 11. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on 101.3 and the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. This program comes to you from the middle of England, right in the heart of the UK, in the beautiful West Midlands region, the Edstone campus. You can get the live stream for this show and any of the KPCG shows at the trumpet.com website and also at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
What sort of country do British Muslims want Britain to be? Channel 4 has commissioned one of the most extensive surveys ever of Muslim communities in the UK. Trevor Phillips presents the results and asks what they reveal about Muslims' attitudes towards British values. What British Muslims really think. Wednesday at 10 on 4.
That would be tonight here in the UK. You can't, I guess that's one program that we can promote that most of you won't be able to get, but we'll try to tune in tonight, or if we miss it tonight, we'll watch it here online tomorrow morning and see if there are some snippets that we might be able to play for you. But judging by some of the articles that you see in the British press, I think what's going to be covered this evening in that documentary has, a lot of it anyway, has been written about. This here from the Telegraph. It's titled, Why the ICM Poll, this extensive survey that little trailer was talking about, why that ICM poll of British Muslims shows we need to defend our values more than ever. That's what the Telegraph is calling on all Brits to think about. It says here tonight on Channel 4, Phillips goes further still with what British Muslims really think. Devastating data collected by ICM suggests that far from following the normal pattern of integration, a chasm is opening up between Muslims and non-Muslims on key issues such as marriage, sexuality, freedom of expression, and even the validity of violence. Of course, many people know about these trends, these developments, but there's so many in the major media that want to cover it up. It says here, the Telegraph does, the constant reassurances that only a tiny number of Muslims hold any of those dreadful views are swiftly revealed to be dangerous, wishful thinking. One in three British Muslims thinks that taking a second wife is acceptable, while 52% say that homosexuality should be illegal. 52%. And so where is the otherwise very vocal homosexual lobby when it comes to this 52% figure? I mean, there's 3 million Muslims now in the UK. That's a large section of the population. And they get a free pass that so many others don't. It says anyone hoping that more liberal voices will emerge from younger Muslims can dream on. 35% of 18 to 24-year-olds think it's cool to keep more than one wife. Are the younger ones integrating? Are young Muslim men, are they integrating? Incorporating Western values into their thinking? Are they taking on British values? Some 23% told ICM they would like there to be areas of Britain where Sharia law is introduced instead of laws laid down by Parliament. 23%, not 2.3, a fourth. It says not long ago, you would have dismissed that scenario, as fantastical. But given that our government has allowed 85 Islamic courts to operate across the UK, we can rule nothing out. Look at the direction. Look at where we're headed. That's what the Telegraph is saying here. The prospect of a country within a country, of zones where gay people are outlawed, adulteresses stoned, women treated as children, and little boys tell a primary school headmistress to cover her head because only slags don't cover their heads. This needs to be resisted with every fiber of our national being, if we have any moral fiber left. After 30 years of multiculturalism, is there any moral fiber left in the British people today? Is there enough strength? Is there enough will to resist against these kinds of views? There's another article that the Wall Street Journal had just recently as well, showing the similarities between some of these Muslim ideas and the radical left. Talk about a bizarre alliance. It says here in the Wall Street Journal, they are also sons of the West, educated in the schools of multiculturalism, reared on the works, talking about radical Islamists, reared on the works of Noam Chomsky and perhaps Francis Fanon, consumers of a news diet heavy with reports of perfidy by American and British or Israeli soldiers. If Islamism is their ideological drug of choice, the political orthodoxies of the modern left are the gateway to it. And then it goes in to discuss the most recent issue of Inspire, which is a radical Islamist publication, a magazine, and a really attractive one at that. I just looked at it online earlier this morning. A beautiful publication on the surface. And all these articles, radical Islamist articles, glorifying Islamic violence. It says here, mixed in with step-by-step photos of how to build a time hand grenade and an analysis of the Charlie Hebdo massacre, there's a long article on the oppression of blacks in America, starting with the killing of Ferguson's Michael Brown. It's in the same publication, which just throws fuel on the fire, which makes them more unhappy and discontented with their host country, whether it's Britain or the United States, which makes them yearn for Sharia law in their neighborhoods, which makes so many of them sympathetic to violence, terrorism, terrorist acts. Again, when you just look at the numbers, if you talk about 3 million Muslims in the UK, and I forget how many million in the United States, but even the ones, the smaller percentage that support acts of terrorism, supposing it is 8 to 10 to 15%, why, this still represents tens of thousands of people. Talk about a country within a country. Well, a couple of more stories here. I don't think I'll spend too much time on these next two that I included in my notes. China's buying up U.S. companies at an alarming rate, and yet no one seems to really care. I mean, it's really skyrocketed just in the last couple of years. All of these U.S. corporations being purchased by Chinese millionaires and billionaires. It says here, the stats is from Fiscal Times. The stats are astonishing. 7 years ago, Chinese acquisitions in the U.S. averaged 13 annually. 13 annually. By 2013, the average was up to 43. Last year, Chinese acquisitions in the U.S. totaled 103. What is happening to the United States? Well, much of it, many of its businesses, many of its corporations, they're for sale. They're going to the highest bidder. And so many of those bidders are coming from Asia, Lastly, this piece here, the piece I mentioned at the top, Can America Change Course? It's an article in the Washington Times by Clifford May, and talking about, it's similar to what I discussed yesterday, that piece from Victor Davis Hanson, where he talked about the rude awakening for America once the next president is in office, and all of the corrections and adjustments that that president's going to have to make, and how he's going to have to give it to the American people straight up. This is the state of our affairs financially. This is where we are after hollowing out the military. The Affordable Care Act has been a disaster. All these foreign policy blunders. It's really undermined our position of strength all over the world. Well, Clifford May here, he talks about, well, how much can one president or one leader even bring about change in a nation the size of the United States after all these years of deterioration and decline? He says here, if the next president decides that America does indeed need to change course, the question will arise, can America change course? After 8 years heading in one direction, inertial forces come into play. Large ships of state rarely make sharp turns. The next president may not have the tools and capabilities needed to enact significantly different policies. The military may require substantial restructuring and, having been shrunk over recent years, rebuilding. The intelligence community may need authorities it doesn't at present enjoy. The next president will make political appointments, but career bureaucrats who've risen during Mr. Obama's tenure may be reluctant agents of change. As a voter, this is Clifford May writing, I'm heartened when I hear candidates say that they'll tear up the Iran deal on day one, but as a policy analyst, I know that may not be possible or even advisable. At the very least, shouldn't the new president take the time necessary to attempt to get allies on board? You think that will be quick or easy? As they say, very similar to what Victor Davis Hanson said in that column I read yesterday. Is there a quick fix? Is there an easy fix? I mean, you listen to some of them, like Donald Trump, and you would think so just based on his words. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to build this. It's going to be different. We're going to be great. It's going to return to the way it once was. It says here, though, the amount of things that need fixing. Well, just to skip down a little bit further, is there an Obama doctrine? And if so, what does it prescribe or proscribe? You would think by now we'd know. But those questions remain controversial. Well, let me just skip ahead. One last little snippet. So if the next president wants to fix what's broken, he or she will have his or her work cut out for him. I'd argue that a new national security doctrine will be needed, a broad conceptual framework, a statement of principles that will serve to clarify objectives and outcomes. Well, and good luck with that. Of course, we know that there's a lot more to this story. If you are a student of Bible prophecy, it's not like the decline, the deterioration, the degeneration is all because of one man or one political group or one party. This is prophesied. Just as sure as America's unbelievable rise to power was also prophesied. Go through the United States and Britain in prophecy. That's something that I want to advertise more on television here in the UK. Because even though written decades ago, well, that booklet is more relevant today than ever before. As we see so many of these curses setting in. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll take one more quick break before we come back to wrap things up for today's program. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The very best minds in the world are in total ignorance of the unprecedented cataclysm that is about to strike. And why have these prophecies not been understood or believed? Because the vital key that unlocks prophecy to our understanding had been lost. That key is the identity of the United States and the British peoples in biblical prophecy. That key has been found. It is presented to those whose unprejudiced eyes are willing to see in this volume, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. The events prophesied to strike the American and British peoples in the next few years are sure. These colossal world events, shrinking the first two world wars into insignificance, will come, but not until the warning has been made available for those whose eyes are willing to see. Request The United States and Britain in Prophecy today. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
But who knows the real meaning of this unprecedented world condition? Never before in the history of mankind has the world faced such a condition. This isn't normal. It's something that never existed before until our time, and yet we're taking it for granted. My friends, where is this leading us? You hear or you read the daily news, but you probably don't really understand it. The newscasters and the newspaper reporters and the editors don't really understand the news that they report. The world's leading statesmen don't really understand it, nor do they realize where it's leading us. The world's top scientists recognize what's happening. They know what's taking place. They contribute to it, while at the same time they say publicly that they are frightened by it and what it portends. But they don't understand it or know how it really is going to come out, what it really means. You'd never suspect that this terrifying and constantly worsening state of world conditions that we're living in right now has anything to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ, or that his gospel had anything to do with today's frightful world conditions, with today's world news. The message that Christ brought from the very Creator God for mankind was a message concerned with world affairs and with world government and with our time now and where it's leading us in the immediate future. It was the good news of a happier world tomorrow into which this very generation is destined to be plunged. He was concerned with today's world happenings that you're reading in your daily newspapers and that you're hearing in the daily newscasts. His message was the advance news of the outcome, revealing to us, if we're not too stupid to listen and to heed, or too prejudiced against anything that might sound like it was in the name of religion, then he came to reveal to us the outcome and precisely where we're headed.
That was the message that Jesus Christ proclaimed, as Herbert Armstrong explained there from one of his old radio broadcasts. He came with a message about world affairs. He actually had quite a lot to say about the terrifying and constantly worsening conditions of this world today and the solution to the problems of this world. World government. That was the message that Jesus Christ brought. That was the message that got Jesus Christ crucified. That was the message that the world rejected. He talked about the latter days, saying that in the last days it would be just like the days before the flood of Noah's day. He said in the last days it would be just like the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, but the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man's revealed. Here's the way it will be. This is the way world affairs will be. These are the terrifying and constantly worsening conditions that you'll see on earth just before the Son of Man is revealed. And so there is hope. There is a solution to these terrifying events, to these very abnormal times, to these violent days. And the solution is that world government, the coming kingdom of God. Jesus Christ was born to be king. And his message about that coming king and its kingdom, that's the message that got him crucified. And that's the message that we're here to proclaim, because it's the world's only hope that Jesus Christ is coming back to this earth to take over and rule from an actual throne that exists on this earth today. Why are there so few on earth who understand these many plain scriptures about this future world ruling government? Why do so many reject these prophecies? Prophecies like Isaiah 9 and verse 6, "For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. For unto us a child is born." It's for us. It's for this civilization. It'll be a new world. It'll be a new world government. But it's for man, as God's purpose and plan is for man to be brought right into his family. Verse 7 says, "Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David." Well, there's that throne, the throne of David, "and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this." In God's zeal, this will be brought about. This is talking about God's family government ruling from a throne that God established in order to replace Satan's government on earth. And that government, when it's in place, will increase forever. And there's going to be no end to the rule from David's throne. That means it just goes on and on for all eternity. Think about these verses. We'll conclude with this, Acts 3. Acts 3 in verse 19, it says, "Repent you therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Eternal, and he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you." That time of refreshing is coming. That time of revival is coming, when God will send Jesus Christ, just as Jesus himself preached. John 14:3, "If I go, I come again." Christ spoke of that. The gospel writers talked about it. Those who wrote the general epistle, certainly the Apostle Paul, and the Apostle John, in the very last chapter of the Bible, it quotes Jesus as saying, "I'm coming quickly." That's the reality. That's the world. That's the kingdom that we pray for. "Thy kingdom come." Verse 21 says, "Whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all of his holy prophets since the world began. So you've heard about this. It was before preached unto you. God has spoken these prophecies. He's spoken about this by the mouth of all the holy prophets since the world began. This time of restitution, that word just means restoring, restoring something that was taken away. The Moffat translation even calls this a great restoration. That time is coming, and it's coming soon. It begins at the establishment of God's kingdom on this earth at the return of Jesus Christ. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Today is Wednesday. Don't forget about Trumpet Hour. That comes up in just a few minutes, right at the top of the next hour, wherever you may be, all over the earth. And wherever you are, don't forget to send us an email and tell us where you listen from and what your listening habits are. Send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you again tomorrow.